Welcome to the GraduCon Career Conference 2020, Careers and Grassroots Organization. Let's review the GraduCon schedule for today. Hopefully, you've already attended Session 1 panels. You are now in Session 2, and again, you're in the Careers and Grassroots Organizations panel. Hopefully, you're in the right room. If not, please check your Zoom link. We would also like for you to join us at noon for our keynote speech from Kai Lee, our provost, as well as Jason Merchant and Daniel Ababa. Please join us this afternoon for our last two sessions, 3 and 4, highlighted here. We'd like to go over a couple of Zoom features to make sure that we have a productive session. Our Q&A feature is where you will type your questions for the panelists. There, you will be able to upvote questions that you like best. This is an important time-saving feature that will help us to get to the most pressing questions because we do have a limited amount of time. Our chat feature will be used solely for technical issues. If you have an issue that you want to notify staff about, such as not being able to hear a panelist, please use this box. Now, we'd like to meet our panel. Today, we have Dante Henderson, the Executive Director and Founder of Made Man Foundation, Shaz Rasool, Executive Director of Student Civic Engagement Initiatives here at the University of Chicago, Kaffi Moraine Patterson, the Director of Student Civic Education and the University Community Service Center here at the University of Chicago, and our moderator, Marquita Amwa, Assistant Director of Community Partnerships at the University Community Service Center here at the University of Chicago. We will have a poll that we would like you to fill out in order to make sure that we are aware of who will be in the room for this panel. Please go ahead and take this poll now.
Okay. So good morning, everyone. Just want to get right into it. Thank you, Dana, for that. Really appreciate our introductions and for letting us know how everyone can vote. So a little bit of the panelists' information was given, but I would love for each of them to talk a little bit more about their work just so that everyone who's attending can get an idea of the work that you've done. So if everyone could just give a brief little introduction of their work, and then I will go into asking you some of the questions that I have prepared. Whoever wants to start.
Okay, well, on my grid, I look like I'm next to you, Marquita, so I'm just gonna go. Hello, everyone. My name is Kaffi Moraine Patterson. I got my PhD from the School of Social Work in 2015, and I'm currently the Director of Student Civic Education in the Community Service Center at the University of Chicago. This poll just... and so broadly what that means is I help students think about how do they translate the skills that they're learning as undergraduates or graduates into sort of civic-minded action at when they leave the University of Chicago and while they're here now. So we oversee programs such as Chicago Bound and Summer Links and all of these immersive experiences that help students think about how to be more thoughtful when they enter and exit communities on campus and normally around the south side of Chicago.
Thank you.
And I'm Mob Dante Henderson. I am a current second year master's student at SSA. I founded the Made Man Foundation in 2016. The mission of our organization is to close the opportunity gap for young Black men in grades 6 through 12 through hip hop therapy, literacy enrichment, and also experiential education. We provide a 6-week young authors program, and we also provide hip hop therapy services to young men in Chicago public schools and also charter schools.
Hi, everyone. I'm Shaz Rasool. I'm the Executive Director of Student Civic Engagement at the university. So in my current role, I think about how to bring all of the different opportunities for university students to engage with communities together in some semblance of coordination. But I'm on this panel mostly because in 2013, I founded the university's Community Programs Accelerator, which is a program that was designed to identify grassroots community organizations and to directly work with them on the challenges and issues that they were working on. And so in that context, I had the opportunity to work with hundreds of grassroots nonprofit organizations and leaders. And hopefully I can share some of that with you today.
Awesome. Thank you all for that. So I'm going to start with one question. And I do want everyone to answer this question, but as I continue on, not everyone has to answer every question posed. What is each of your personal definition of grassroots? Some people may not know what that means. And how does it inform the way that you understand your work and the responsibility you have as UOC alum?
I think I'll take that first. Being grassroots for me is just I was a common person with an idea that I thought would really benefit, the population I was serving. When I was a teacher, I realized that a lot of my students were coming in with social emotional issues and really needed a space to kind of process their feelings because it was starting to kind of seep into their behaviors at school. I experienced a lot of absenteeism, students coming to school depressed, which resulted in behavioral issues. And I knew my role was only going to be so much as a teacher. So I started to go down the social work route. And I got a few jobs and it really kind of, just kind of lit my fire just as a common person. And I wanted to develop something that I thought would be representative of what my students actually needed. So, being grassroots is just, just regular people like me and you, just starting things from the ground up, using the resources that we're given. My nonprofit is strictly, funded by common people such as my friends, family, my own personal paycheck most of the time, and just really taking that you can do it yourself approach and just really getting the community involved and getting other people excited about your ideas. And for me, I come from the school of hip hop and, I watched a lot of other rappers, take a lot of their ideas and build them from the ground up. So grassroots for me is just, taking a little bit of nothing and making it into something.
I think I have very little to add to Dante's definition. It very much mirrors my own. For me, it's I have a background in anthropology before I came to the social work degree, and for me, it's just very much focused on people. It is sort of people-led, and it looks very much at cultures and the power that people have to influence and change the spaces around them. And so when I was at SSA, I studied the ways that high-performing students of color pick their colleges, and it was very much sort of at a grassroots level, and that students were telling me about how their experiences of high school and the cultures embedded in those high schools informed the ways they navigated the college search. So exactly what Dante said, it's people-led, and it locates the power within those people.
The only thing I would add to this is that a lot of times people think, so institutions think they know what the challenges people are facing are, whether it's a university or a government or the news media or philanthropy. What grassroots community organizing or grassroots nonprofits, they are addressing the problems that they see and feel directly, right? There's the level of abstraction is often removed, and it's very personal, and it's very place-based often around the experience that peers are having. A lot of times when you talk about social work or nonprofit work, I feel like there's a level of abstraction that's added to this that is sort of counterproductive in a lot of ways, whereas the grassroots groups, they're looking to figure out how to solve a problem for a person down the street or for the neighborhood that we live in. And I think that's something that's very powerful.
Great, thank you so much. I also wanted to ask, all of you have been educated at UChicago, And, you know, obviously all of the participants are current students, masters or PhDs or postdocs at UChicago. So I do want each of you to answer this. How has your education influenced your decision to go into the grassroots arena?
I can say, because I'm on the other side now, but you all shouldn't say this, but I think SSA is similar to other PhD programs at U of C in that you're not really supposed to entertain other careers other than becoming a professor when you get a PhD. It's just really not talked about, and it's often frowned upon by advisors. I was so fortunate at SSA to have a bunch of advisors who allowed me to imagine what I could do. And so my trajectory was a bit different. I started off as a tenure track professor at Dominican University for 3 years. I love my students. Then I moved to Chicago Scholars, where I was the vice president of programming, and now I'm back at U of C. Marquita, remind me what the question was. I knew where I was going that I forgot.
How's your education influenced your decision to enter the grassroots scene?
Got it. Okay, that makes sense of what I was saying. And so what was critical to me in being comfortable with that transition was that U of C instilled in me, it wasn't necessarily the PhD, but it was the way that I was trained to think about problems. And I could take that sort of set of critical thinking skills and evaluative tools and writing to any setting that I went. And so there was a bit of an internal wrestling when I decided to leave the academy, but I made my way back in a different way. And I'm so pleased with the impact I'm able to have. But I was largely able to reconcile that because of the skills that I got from my PhD, but also the ways that the community at SSA allowed me to imagine how those skills and tools could translate into different work than is often posed to most students.
Let me add a couple of things to what Kaffi just said from my experience. So, I was a sociologist as an undergraduate and a computer scientist as a graduate student here at the university. So I was trained to think about patterns and systems and how interactions worked and how you could measure and see change over time. Those skills translate really well into all kinds of different problem areas. You know, just that discipline of thinking, that sort of understanding that you have to see challenges from different perspectives and different timescales is just very helpful. I think that your education is only part of the story, though. Like, you have to have a little bit of something inside you that makes you want to say, hey, I don't want to operate at a level of abstraction. I actually want to care about people or issues. And I think grassroots community organizing or grassroots nonprofit give you that opportunity to sort of fuse those two areas, your sort of your personal drive and values, plus the sort of analytic and writing skills that your education has afforded you. And I think that's a thing, right? Like, how do you think about how to use that privileged education that we have acquired in a way that's constructive for us, for society at large.
With me, I kind of started my organization pretty much from the ground up. There was a lot of things that I took from my previous careers, such as teaching. I've been a college counselor before. I've done social work. So, I mean, a lot of my lenses came in, you know, very diverse, but there was still some things that I just was rusty in. So with me being a clinical student at SSA, I'm learning a lot of the modalities and interventions that are really successful working with the population that I'm serving, becoming more trauma-informed, learning about cognitive behavioral therapy. So it's really kind of deepen my practice, you know, as a clinician, and it helps to really inform the services that I'm offering through my nonprofit. But also, too, one thing I like about SSA is they give you the opportunity to take a few admin classes as well. And the admin classes were really kind of important for me just because, you know, paying attention to things like politics, you know, the other side of the ballgame, actually running an organization and all of the dynamics and political things that go into that. That was really helpful for me because that was a part of, you know, just starting a nonprofit that I didn't even really think about, because while I had been in leadership, you know, I really never studied, you know, administrative things from that lens. So that was pretty key. And then also just being attached to the university, you know, I actually met Shaz Razul in 2016 when I first got my 501c3 license. So, you know, just being attached to the university and utilizing the resources, you know, inside the classroom and also outside of the classroom through the community's engagement department, you know, it's been really key into building an organization that, you know, has just been adding on pieces every year. And it's been a really blessed experience for me and the people that I serve.
Okay, so just going off of the conversation that we're having right now, I have other scripted questions, but just thinking about some of the things that you all mentioned, and Shaz, you kind of touched on this a little bit in your answer. Grassroots quite literally means working at the bottom, working at the roots of everything. How do you reconcile that with, like you said, Shaz, kind of the privilege of the university and the fact that maybe a lot of grassroots organizations in Chicago itself, specific to Southside, might be at conflict with the university, so to speak. Shaz, I know you have lots of information on this, so I will let you go last. And maybe if Kafi and Dante have something to say about it.
Mine is very simple. So Shaz, I think I'll totally let, and Dante take the lead on this, but I very much believe whatever power I have, it is my responsibility to then make sure that I'm using the university's resources for the betterment of those organizations. Whether that mean trying to cater all of our events with local organizations, being mindful of offering our student volunteerism and support to those local grassroots organizations. However I can, within my authority and those around me, get those groups to be on the university's lens, feels very much important to me. I'm from Hyde Park as well, so from that perspective, but also as someone who is very much reaping the benefits of the university.
Can you read the question one more time?
Okay, I said kind of how do you, Shaz touched on this, but how do you reconcile kind of the privilege of being at the university and also reconciling that with the fact that a lot of grassroots organizations may be at conflict with the university or may in themselves be going against the privilege of the university?
Perfect. I just really make sure that while, you know, my black face does, you know, provide familiarity with most of my clients, being that I serve, you know, young black men and I serve their families as well, I do recognize that oftentimes I'm coming in from two different experiences. You know, my mother, you know, she had to work to kind of send me to school, but some of the, you know, the challenges that my clients have experienced, you know, I didn't grow up with. And I don't want to come in, you know, saying, hey, your life should be like this. You know, I want to be culturally sensitive to everybody that I'm serving. I don't want to come in othering people unintentionally or intentionally. And I always make sure that I'm serving, you know, the people, you know, with the things that they need. One of the things that I've actually scrapped from my program and some schools that I've served was the literacy program. You know, I used to have this super belief, and SSA has actually helped me to check that at the door, is that, you know, I had this theory that, you know, if you could read and write really well, this could really help change the opportunity gap. And like, nah, like I could completely kind of throw that out the window, because it's hella black people that read and write really well. And like, yo, we still, you know, trying to get ahead of society. So, you know, I've really kind of reevaluated my practice, my mission statement. And while it still serves a purpose in my organization, I approach it from a different lens. And that's helped me to become more, you know, practice humility in my own little way. And it's made me a better, just a better leader in the community. But honestly, I just come from it with a very humble approach. And I try to be people led, because while I did start this organization for my own passion and my own interests, I do have to aware that I'm in the room as much as the people are in the room. And I got to make sure that I'm always people first. And me second. So yeah, that really helps me.
So I'll build off of this people first. I think all career discussions are ultimately about relationships, and all sort of professional work, whether it's, you know, at an office, at an institution, at a business, it turns into relationship work. When you're working with nonprofit grassroots organizations, it starts at relationship work. And I think there's a, and I think that that, you know, that that's like, because the organizations are smaller, because the issues are more immediate, the quality and strength of those relationships ends up being very important for partnerships with other organizations or institutions, and for just the internal work culture at the organizations. Coming in with a U of C degree or a U of C background into a Southside nonprofit, there's going to be a relationship building component to that. And so a lot of times what we do here at the university is we encourage students who have this interest to start volunteering or to start engaging community organizations in their work right away. So that way, beyond sort of the benefit to our university student where they're learning about what the world really looks like on the ground or what the organizations are doing, it also gives an opportunity to build that relationship, right? We need to get to the point where people are looking at, if you want to do this work, like you have to be an individual in this work. You can't be an institution or a stereotype or anything else, right? Like, so how do you build relationships to get to that point where you're an individual in the work? The short answer is you do it by doing good work and by showing up and by being reliable and by putting all of those good personal qualities that you have into the mix in support of the cause or the mission of the organization. You're not gonna get to this work by scrolling through LinkedIn in the same way, right? Like, you're gonna get to this work by talking to people and by sort of getting involved in activities. I think that's the key thing. And I think the big differentiator between this kind of work and working in philanthropy or higher ed or any of the other sort of versions of nonprofit work that exist.
Yeah, thank you. And that's a great transition into my next question, which I promise isn't as philosophical, I can't speak now. Philosophical, that's the word. Do you mind telling me about any organizations you were involved in while at UChicago? On or off campus? I feel like that's a great transition from what Chaz was saying about relationships and being involved in actual activities.
I can just throw some out there. So I worked some years back with the anti-eviction campaign in South Africa, and I continued that work. There's a local chapter here. When I was getting my master's degree at U of I, it's different than SSA. They allow you to take all of your courses at once and then do your field placement somewhere else. And I actually did my field placement at the Race Center on campus. And that was at the time, Waldo Johnson, who's the professor at SSA, was the director there. And that relationship and the many organizations I joined through him were foundational to me then applying to SSA for the PhD and doing work there. Within SSA, there were a lot of student sort of organizing for rights for students that I was involved in. As a high parker, I was at all CPS sort of meetings I attended. So I just felt it was really important to be studying these things, but be rooted very much in the ways that real families were impacted sort of by these things, or sort of not abstractly thinking about policy. And at the time I was raising my brother who has special needs. So I was very much invested in learning about the ways the CPS was thinking about special education resources. Those are just a few.
For me, it was the Community Action Bureau through the Harris School of Public Policy. There is pretty much Harris School of Public Policy. They partnered with the Community Accelerator Program to provide their I'm sorry, I can't talk now, to provide their students an opportunity to work with grassroots organizations on various projects. I've been a part of two or three CAB teams. I think the first year they helped me out with, developing my program design. So I had about three or four students on my team. We kind of met at the beginning of the quarter, and I kind of let them know exactly what I need. They then went back to kind of develop a game plan for how we would go do work together. So they provided like research for me. They built a database for me, helped me build a website, connected me with different partners. And pretty much the Community Accelerator Program, they've been a really big help. I actually started working with them even before I became a student. And actually, truthfully, I don't even know if I didn't partner with the Community Accelerator Program, I probably would not be an SSA student to this day. So, because, my journey into social work was kind of just like I zigzagged all around education. But when I found out that University of Chicago was doing really, really good work in the community, it made me want to even look at the program at SSA. So big shout out to the Community Accelerator Program.
So when I was an undergrad, I worked in the Neighborhood Schools Program. I'll always say that that's probably the best thing I did as a university student. It gave me an opportunity to build real relationships with principals, teachers, kids, and to just add a dimension to my university experience that, I was an undergrad in the 90s, and so it was a different place, arguably a much worse place. So I needed that sort of experience in order to sort of balance things out. When I was a grad student, I was actually working at the university on a digital divide project while I was getting my master's degree in computer science. And so we were working with CPS, the Chicago Public Schools, on getting computers and upgrading the networks in the sort of mid-2000s. And so that work was really important. And then as an offshoot of that, I got involved in a bunch of these digital access nonprofit groups and grassroots groups. So the Chicago Digital Access Alliance and some of these groups. And it was really interesting to see how different sort of technologists were thinking about problems that that frankly we are facing today in very stark terms 10 years ahead. Without the societal will to really go after making sure that everybody had a computer, everybody had a decent quality internet connection at an affordable cost. And so that makes me want to just underline this idea that a lot of times the grassroots groups are the canaries in the coal mine, in the sense that they are seeing problems earlier before they reach the bigger society. And I think that if you care about society, if you're a futurist, if you, like to think about how things will play out over time, looking at what the grassroots groups are focusing on gives you a lot of insight.
Great, thank you. So kind of a little bit more pointed questions to each of you. So Dante, you're currently doing your master's. I think that that's really important for a lot of our attendees who are listening to understand kind of how do you balance both currently getting a degree and then really doing this grassroots work at the same time.
So it is, it's not as hard as, I don't know, I'm used to being busy. So that kind of helps out. It gives me a little bit of an edge also. I mean, I came into grad school at the age of, I was, 35, 34. So I was very focused in on what I wanted to do. So that kind of made the transition into doing this and doing that and doing this again, a little bit seamless, but it is challenging. I make sure that I really rely on my Google Calendar a lot. And I really set some really good boundaries in my life so that I make sure I get everything done with the highest level of integrity. And also I was really, amazed at how supportive SSA has been with me, you know, building a nonprofit, running a nonprofit. So I actually talked to them, you know, after my first year of field placement, and they approved my nonprofit to actually be my actual field site. So I'm actually able to kill two birds with one stone. And that's pretty helpful because, you know, I came to SSA to inform the clinical services of my nonprofit. So it only made sense for me to actually be, you know, applying those things that I'm learning in the classroom to my internship. And it's been very beneficial and it's made life a lot easier. So while, you know, it just, once I leave class, I go do programming, I go meet with my clients and, you know, it's really been a big blessing. But honestly, I don't feel like you can't work a job and then also go to school. I'm in the evening program at school. My life has kind of transitioned a little bit. So I'm kind of like a almost full-time student now. So I'm taking a few more classes in the daytime, but it's very possible. I do most of my classes probably like later on in the day. And then I do, you know, organizational stuff in the morning. So I usually have about like an hour gap in the day. I usually stop working probably like around 6, 7, 8 at night sometimes, and I'm able to still have a life. I have not been, you know, too grouchy. You know, there are peak seasons to where, you know, work has kicked up a little bit more than others, but honestly, I still have a life. I'm able to, you know, pay my bills, and I'm doing really well academically in school. So, you know, just use your resources and don't be afraid to ask the school, the university for what you need. There is so many resources on campus, you know, for you to utilize and for you to be successful. So if you feel like you need to work a full-time job, go to school, that's an option. And I mean, don't be afraid of that. I feel like, you know, when you ask the universe for what you need and you put the work in and your eyes are open and you're receptive, I feel like the universe grants you different things. So yeah, no, it is a balance, but it is something that you can be healthy with and it can really work out for you.
Great. And Shaz, we've talked a lot about the Community Programs Accelerator, but I'm not sure all of our attendees really know what that means or how that work is definitely rooted in grassroots. So do you mind just giving us the bare bones about everything that you do with that?
Sure. So the university is a really decentralized place. And when you're on the inside of the university, you kind of figure out how to navigate it. But when you're on the outside of the university, it's completely nonsensical to you in terms of who am I supposed to go to for what. And so what we found was that there were a lot of community organizations and a lot of individuals who just had no idea how to navigate the university and had no idea of what the university could actually do to help them. Because you know, when you don't know what to ask for, the default is to ask for money because then you can use money to do whatever. But if you ask the wrong person for money, the answer is almost always going to be no. So what we were finding was that people were asking, community groups were asking folks at the university for money who didn't have money. They were saying no, and the community was mad at the university, or the community group was mad at the university about X, Y, or Z. So that was the problem we were trying to solve. How do you create a space where there's a clear entryway for a community organization to ask the university for support? And how can we think about support that goes beyond dollars? Because community organizations have a whole range of different kinds of needs that go beyond dollars. And so we founded the Community Programs Accelerator in 2014 as a one-stop shop where a community organization could write an application talking about who they are and what they're doing and what their next 6 months look like. And then we could look at those applications and say, well, this is a good, what, you know, you have a data collection issue, this is a good project to loop in the Community Action Bureau. And we can help you solve your data collection problem through this partnership with a community organization. Or you're having a communications messaging problem. Here, let's ask our colleagues at the university's communications office to help you talk through it. And so on. So we'd use those applications as a way to create opportunities to help community organizations solve their problems, which is the main impetus. In the structure, we ended up, we did have some cash, so we were able to give some grant money out to some groups. We were able to create a stream for a sort of project-based engagement for a quarter or so. And then we were able to help create community between all the community organizations. So we launched a workshop series. So every month there would be one or two open workshops on topics that addressed common themes out of the applications. And those would be open and free to community organizations to participate in. And so we'd then bring in a fundraising professional to give advice on fundraising tactics. The benefit from that was twofold. One, in that it got education information out to community groups who needed it. But two, it gave us a space to help create a community of the community organizations where the university was a part of it, but was not necessarily we were the venue, but we weren't the driver of it. And I hope people are picking up from the way I'm telling this story that what was neat about this was that it was just very responsive to what the community groups actually needed and what the issues they were surfacing were. I think a lot of times, when you're, philanthropy, I think is the most sort of notorious about this. They will decide. Everybody needs, Bill Gates says everybody needs this. And so then, everybody gets what Bill Gates says, right? And with this project, the university was really good about sourcing information from the community groups, giving them space to sort of consult us on what they needed. And in a lot of cases, the workshop presenters were other members of the community, right? So if we were going to do a session on circle keeping or different justice kinds of initiatives, like we would invite the expert from the community to share their experience with other community organizations. This idea that the university is not the sort of sole owner of all of the expertise was really important to us in the design of that project. And I think that's part of why that program was particularly well received by our community partners.
Great, thank you. Okay, Coffee, I'm gonna shout you out a little bit because I know your life. Coffee's my boss for people who are watching. So you have your PhD, you're also a mother, you also currently teach, or you just did in this past quarter. Do you mind talking about a little bit twofolded, how your dissertation informs your work, and also if you bring some of that into the classroom, as some of the people watching may be thinking about going that professor route?
So thanks for the shout out. So the question is, do I bring my dissertation work into the classroom where I taught at SSA? Yes, absolutely. I did it at Dominican, and I did it here at SSA, but I encourage students to do that as well. I think people will often find sort of a passion in what they're talking about when it is something that they are directly sort of invested in. But what I encourage social workers to do, and I even play a game with my students, is I say, no matter what topic you think interests you, for me, it will always intersect with something else. I can always make a connection. And I think that is a critical skill for social workers, to think intersectionally. So yes, my dissertation was super specific in that I studied the ways that high-performing Black and Brown students navigate high schools and then ultimately choose colleges. and what their experiences were in those colleges, depending on if they chose a college that matched their academic qualifications or they undermatched them. But I would say throughout all of that as well, I also ended up studying family systems, right? So a lot of these students were being raised by grandparents. So there was an intersection of gerontology in there. A lot of the students were experiencing homelessness. So there's no topic for me as a social worker that we can't think intersectionally about. And so I enter into the space always talking about education traditionally, but I always make space for thinking about citizenship. Who's regarded as a citizen? Who isn't? How do those experiences intersect, especially with groups who are historically pitted against each other? I think it absolutely informs it. And then to your point about, I have two small girls. I'm surprised no one has heard them in the background yet. And then when I actually started the PhD program, I became the guardian of my brother who has autism. Similar to Dante, I've had no less than one job since I was 14. So throughout my entire time at SSA, I had about two jobs the whole time. And I was a full-time PhD student navigating CPS for my brother. That was the same year I got married. I pledged my sorority and I moved into a home. So that year will sort of live in infamy. But all that to say, the most important thing I learned as a PhD student was, I think we tend to come into these spaces and think that there's only one faculty member who can help us. There's only one faculty member whose research most speaks to ours. And while that can be true, I think it was critical for me to see that I ultimately needed to just find the people who were invested in me. Often these were people who had children. People who had some connection with special needs population, and they often did not study anything that I studied. The woman who ended up being my chair, when the woman who was supposed to be my chair was no longer able to, was Sydney Hans, and she studies babies. So, you know, she laughed at the idea of helping me on dissertation about college, but she was the best person I could have had, and it was just it was an important life lesson. Find the people who are invested in your graduating. They may not be experts in your area, but there's no professor at SSA who isn't brilliant, and they can lend a certain lens to your work that makes it stronger. When I was working with Sydney, who wasn't familiar with college language, she wouldn't allow me to use certain sort of jargony words because she's like, nobody's going to understand. So that actually made me become sharper, and I had to explain my point better. And it wouldn't have been the case if I had stuck with people who were more rooted in that field. So I try to bring those personal experiences to the work that I do with you and the Community Service Center, and absolutely to the classroom when I'm connecting with social work students.
Great, thank you. Okay, I have two more questions before I open it up to the Q&A, and I've seen some of the questions coming in and they're great. So my first one is very simple. Do any of you have like a really rewarding moment you've had while working in your respective areas? And what was that rewarding moment? And I will ask you to keep it a bit short so we have time for questions. Everyone's thinking?
Yes. the very first school contract I got, that was rewarding for me because in 2016, when I first started my organization, we didn't have any clients. It was really just an idea. We were still really in a Google Doc, just kind of really testing some things out. I was pitching the idea to people. I went in, I did a few facilitations, but there was still no official business that was really kind of established. So 2017, when I got my first school contract, that was a big moment to where I realized that my, impact was felt. And honestly, I really didn't have to do too much pitching. It was from a referral. And people would just saw me going to a lot of different meetings, pitching the idea, and they reached out to me. And I think that year was a big kind of a turning point for my organization because then it just became like running water at that point. I got a chance to test out a lot of ideas. I saw the impact that I made with the students. A lot of my students are now doing really well on their way to their senior years in high school probably now. Just when you see your dreams come alive, I think for me, that moment was getting my first school contract with this with a charter school in the South Side. So yeah, for me, that was it.
I worked at the consortium while at U of C, and it's exciting now because I'm actually on the steering committee, but many moons ago, I had no idea that that would happen. But while working with Melissa Roderick, we did the on-track work. And so a lot of that was just getting students to turn in their FAFSA forms, which was a huge barrier to the college process. Now CPS's FAFSA the completion rate is somewhere in the 90%. And it was a lot, it was probably half of that back then. So that felt like an immediate accomplishment because it was largely Black and Brown and low-income students who weren't completing it. I personally worked on the college match study, and that just sort of changed the way that schools, that public schools and even some private schools thought about the college going process and the needs of students. For the first time, we were looking at academic qualifications matching with the qualifications of a college in a different way, and which led to us putting often low-income, first-gen, Black and Brown students into colleges where they were more likely to graduate. So that felt really good to be a part of a team who was thinking about that. And to this day, CBS has adopted that model and moves forward with it. But it started very much at a grassroots level. It started with talking to family members and to students directly and teachers organizing around us. So that was certainly a highlight.
So in our first year at the Community Programs Accelerator, we took in a group called the Dovetail Project by Sheldon Smith, and who was a Woodlawn resident. And the program works with young fathers between 18 and 24, and it gives them, and it has a, it has basically three parts. There's a set of life and parenting skills. There's a set of education around felony street law so that the young men can navigate their interactions with the police and with the criminal justice system in a more productive way. And then there's a GED and job readiness sort of facet. So the program was tiny when we took it in. And our work at the accelerator in the first year was around his curriculum in order to help tighten the curriculum, make it stronger, be able to show learning gains for the young men that were in his program. And then the second thing we worked with is on data tracking and sort of thinking, helping him think through what the different sort of short, medium, and long-term impacts that he could track were. And then we really focused on helping him with his communication strategy. And within 2 years, Sheldon's program grew from a small program on the South Side to a medium-sized program on the South Side and starting to replicate on the West Side. CNN picked him up as a CNN hero. And so he got national publicity. And then a new philanthropic organization, and I'm forgetting their name, Liz Dozier's organization.
Right. Chicago Beyond?
Chicago Beyond made them a $1 million grantee and added, and through that funding, he was able to add caseworkers to his program to stick with the young men after the program, which was a thing we had recommended he think about in his roadmap for what's the better version of your program. And so to be able to see a grassroots community-led effort grow and thrive, thanks to like some really focused support from a university, has been one of the most sort of impactful and sort of feel good moments that I've had as a professional in this space.
Great. Okay, and my last question that I ask you, keep it short. What is, a few words of advice you have for anyone looking into going into the grassroots scene?
I'd say you're in Chicago, which is an amazing, unique space for grassroots organizing, like historically, like out, you're on the South Side, don't miss the opportunity to connect with organizations now. I don't, you know, you don't wait until you've graduated to do that. This is something you've ideally been doing your whole life, or at least while you've been here, like you're open to that. So I'd say go to the spaces where this is where meetings are held. CPS has open meetings all the time. For CPS, for me, is often very grassroots in organizing. I think we're in a crazy time right now. I just thought about my advice where you can't actually potentially go, but I'm sure a lot of these groups are having virtual meetings of some kind. And I think a lot of them, so we used to do work, for example, with it's not grassroots, but it's Cradles to Crayon. We've just learned, for example, that we can't support them historically the way that they've needed to be, but they likely still need support. And so I think it's finding ways in this virtual world that we live in that you can still support organizations, but the grassroots ones in particular, who maybe don't even have the tech capacity, who don't sort of have these other things that the larger ones do, and just getting creative. And to Shasta's point earlier, organizations don't always know the ways that they can be helped. I think they have maybe a few ways in mind, but even lending areas of expertise that you find value in could be very helpful. And so I just encourage you to reach out to organizations. And after this, I'm sure Shaz and I can do a brainstorm, Dante totally, and we can create a list of potential organizations if you need some direction in that to turn your time to. We'd love to do that to make it easier for you. But certainly these organizations are hopefully still thriving and still need support. And so it's finding ways to connect with them in this virtual world that we now live in.
I would just say your small niche interests could be of greater value to mankind. Some of the skills that I've had that can be overlooked, such as just holding space for people. There are people out there that need space to be held for them. You know, just you are the true representation of what somebody needs, and don't underestimate your value and what you can bring to a community. You know, just simple things such as me teaching kids, you know, how to successfully talk to a teacher without it turning into a confrontation. That's a social emotional skill that, you know, some people wouldn't even think that you would need to even teach somebody that, but there is, you know, there are kids, there are even people, adults that just really need that type of skill. So, you know, your unique skill set is something that the world needs. So tap into whatever that genius have inside and yeah, use it. And just bottle up that magic and, you know, try to, you know, get it out there. And also just use your resources. One of the things that I learned through my journey as a social entrepreneur is don't try to do it all by yourself. There are organizations out there on campus and even off campus. I know, you know, they got the Community Accelerator Program, but then they also have organizations like the Urban League of Chicago that are out there providing really good resources to growing organizations. So, you know, just tap in and also utilize your network. Oftentimes, I think we don't really search inside of the gold inside of our own phone books. So, yeah, just use your resources and bottle up the inner genius and market it. And I think you will do a good job.
The only thing I would say is that you are more than your degree, right? Like there's a whole set of qualities that make you you. Figure out which one of those you want to sort of connect to the world, and you know, when we're talking about this kind of grassroots engagement, this is about sort of making a difference in the lives of others very quickly, and often making a difference in the lives of others that that the institutions are not serving well. Right, whether it's the government or whether it's whoever. And so you got to, you know, to do this kind of work, you have to have a little bit of that spark in you. And I think almost everybody does have that spark. It's a question about whether or not they want to share that with the world. And so I think you all clearly have the intellect, and through your education and training, you have a whole toolkit of skills and that are of benefit. The question is really for you to just wrestle with how do you want to put your spirit into the work, and what work is that? And like Coffee said, like your fourth, one of the real great privileges of being at an elite university like the University of Chicago is you have an entire subset of staff members that are really invested in your ongoing success. And so I do always say that you should use every resource the university has for you, whether it's at UChicago Grad or the Community Service Center or the Community Programs Accelerator, you know, whichever resources there are, like you should use them, right? Like, I mean, all of these resources are here for you to help you be the best version of you that you can be. I think that's the key thing.
Great. Well, thank you so much for answering my questions. I'm now going to go to the Q&A section. We've had quite a few questions come in. So I'm going to start with the ones that are voted the most. So here we go. Okay, this came in from Anna, and it says, I'm a social work student, and she's wondering if any of you could speak about the ways about bringing grassroots work into spaces that are very bureaucratic and top down, particularly public school systems.
You want to get this one first, Coffee?
Okay.
Okay. Oftentimes, CPS definitely can be very bureaucratic. I mean, I can even talk to you about the process of me trying to get my vendor license. Oftentimes, there is not a very direct answer back, if you're trying to get in contact with like a principal. I've been very successful at utilizing the people that are actually on the ground, like teachers are a very good entryway to get a conversation with the principal. Let's just say if you're trying to get a program inside a school, or if you're trying to come in there and do like a workshop of some sorts, you can oftentimes use teachers. And like as Shaz has said, everything first starts with a relationship. You oftentimes have to kind of develop a relationship with at least one person. And then from there, you utilize that person as leverage to get to other people, such as a principal, an assistant principal. Also times at CPS schools, they have these positions called resource coordinators, and resource coordinators are responsible for bringing in different community programs, activities with inside of the school. Sometimes they call like a resource coordinator. They might be called a youth intervention specialist or something like that. What you'll find is within CPS, people might be in the system as one different title, but then they serve a function in the school that is an entirely other different way. But that's oftentimes the best way. And I wouldn't say waste your time sending a whole bunch of emails. Sometimes a good old pop-up and just kind of just waiting in the office for about 1 to 2 hours will kind of get the attention, and the secretary will finally say, hey, what were you here for? It's worked a whole bunch of times for me. I just made sure I carved out about 2 to 4 hours out of my day just to be like, hey, I'm going to just wait until somebody talks to me. It really helps to have a clear plan of what you're expecting to do. It really helps to kind of like look at maybe like the school report card to see what areas that they're kind of struggling in, just because while you might think it's a really good idea that this school has it, that school might not actually even need that. Do your due diligence in terms of like getting as much research in. But if you want to work with a school directly, I would say just really find you one person that can be your champion and use that as leverage to talk to other people that are the decision makers inside of the school.
I think that's spot on. I would just add sort of some questions. One, lead with how you can make their lives easier. These people are exhausted. I think similar to social work, they're pulled in a million different directions. So if you lead with the idea of making their lives easier, they're inclined to listen a bit more, I found. I might say, instead of creating something new, might you enhance an already approved program or something that's already going on and just add in onto it? That might make sort of approvals faster. I largely believe that bureaucracies in general, this is not just CPS, they count on you giving up. Like that is, they don't post their numbers online. Like When I was trying to get services for my brother, it was literally a 3-year battle with CPS. And it was a lot, but I think I was so fortunate. At the time, Charles Payne, who was my professor at SSA, had just been designated the interim CEO of CPS with Terry Mazzani from the Trust. So I was fortunate to be in a world where I could talk to someone who knew something about CPS. So also, like, you're at the University of Chicago. There are tons of people at SSA in particular who have connections that could help you. Lastly, use an alum. So I was an alum of Kenwood Academy. That helped me. If you know other people at the school or faculty or in Chicago who are alums, that's often, to Shaz's point about relationships, they can send an email that makes somebody a little bit more likely to respond to you. And it's not, it's just because people are busy. I don't take things personal. I think people are genuinely busy. Probably the most important is lead with making their lives easier. And I think you're more inclined to get a response if you can do that.
Great. Okay, so the next question is from Maurice. How do you balance remaining grassroots and collaborating with political or economic movements that are on a higher level? Anyone?
I think what I've seen is you have to keep the eyes on who your constituents really are. And a lot of times grassroots groups get invited to tables with a lot of different, with sort of the city or with philanthropy or with, you know, anchor institutions like the university. And some of the times those are not going to be productive conversations because the bigger institutions have their own agenda. The city wants to do something. But I think it's important that the grassroots groups, they take every opportunity to get into those spaces. And they use those opportunities to speak truth to power. I think this is part of, you're not going to win every argument or every fight you're in, but if you don't use the opportunities to speak truth to power, the people you're representing will not get their voices heard at all. And I think that is part of the burden of doing grassroots work, is that you are taking the position of the people you are trying to serve and benefit. Through our community programs, accelerator work, you know, we worked with the Chicago Hyde Park Village, which was an intergenerational group that's focused on seniors. They brought a senior perspective into every meeting that they had with anybody. Even when the meeting wasn't really about seniors, they brought that perspective. And I think that is the, you know, when we talk about advocacy, that is part of what you do in the grassroots world, right? Whether it's seniors or whether it's young people who are in the juvenile justice system, or whether it's, families with special needs students, you know, whoever your constituent is, like, you have to bring them into whatever room you can get into. And I think that's part of it. I think that gets to the question.
Yeah, for sure. I think actually I'll just move on to the next question. So I'm gonna skip around a little bit. So we have a question from Amanda, and she says, from the poll, a good amount of us are in the physical sciences division. What are some ways for physical scientists and people without backgrounds in social sciences to get involved in grassroots orgs, but use the skill sets that they have?
Well,
good chat. I was about to say you go. Yeah.
So some of the skills are about data. Some of them are about observing, observation. Some of them are about sort of thinking about models. And some of them are about how different systems interact with each other, sort of, you know, at a level of abstraction. And so I think all of those skills are applicable, you know, and you know, you're still a human in the world, so you still care about housing, and you still care about food, and you still care about education, and you still want safety, but you don't want oppression of people in order to get to safety. So I don't think that, you know, I don't think that physical science, social sciences divide is as stark as people often will like to make it think. I mean, you may not have training in very specific areas like social work, but I think you're still well suited for a lot of the kinds of work that we're talking about. I don't know, Coffee or Dante, if you want to add to that, but
no, I think that's spot on. And I would say one of the things I appreciated about being at SSA was that the faculty are not all social workers. In fact, most are not. So my advisor had a background in economics, for example. And what I found so valuable is the different sets of questions that we would bring to the same problem. And I think that's a really important thing that someone in physical sciences could do. Because I think when you're in a room full of people who are thinking about things the same way, a lot of innovation doesn't happen. And so I encourage you to be, to sort of honor and be excited about the different ways that you could approach a similar, a problem, a shared problem, and the unique kind of skills and competencies you could bring to that. And to Shaz's point, being in the physical sciences doesn't remove you from wanting the same things that social workers do. We just probably look at it from a different way, but both can be enhanced. And I think that's where innovation actually happens, when different people from different backgrounds are looking at the same thing and trying to problem solve it together.
Great. Okay, then. Okay, just moving on. So the next question is from Brandon, and it says, I wanted to ask a question about abstraction. How do you navigate working with individuals when many social problems stem from large historical forces? I think everyone on this panel could say something to that.
There's a horrible phrase, you can't eat the elephant all at once, which I'm not quite sure where it comes from, like who is out there eating elephants, but the essential idea of it is that, you know, a lot of times people will say, you know, we really have to get to the root of this problem before we can do anything. And while intellectually that sounds like, of course we want to get to the root of the problem, oftentimes I feel like it's a dodge for having to deal with the reality of the problem. And so in all of these cases, I feel like, you know, if you get to make a choice whether you're gonna be on the policy side and whether you're gonna sort of do work that might have an impact 20 years down the road, because it's gonna take you 10 years in order to get to a policy prescription that will have an impact, or whether you're gonna work on the people side and you're gonna ameliorate the negatives immediately, and you're gonna figure out, okay, well, how do I, you know, given the world we live in, how do we make the best of it? I tend to think that a lot of the grassroots work sits on this shorter timeline, people focused. I think there's space to do both. I mean, I think, you know, we have a group in the Community Programs Accelerator called Pilot Light. And what they're focused on is like on food. And so they do a set of healthy eating food programs for young people and families, but they're also trying to work on setting food policy standards that schools can adopt, right? And so that's a nice example of being a both and kind of organization. I think that this is the case, the world we live in, where some parts of these problems are gonna be on a very long time scale and some parts are gonna be short. You can't do it all. If it was easy, we would have solved all of these problems already. And so you're going to have to figure out, okay, given who you are and what your interests are, which approach are you going to take personally, and how much change are you going to try to affect, and what kind it is, and you know, how you know, is your action going to give you a sense of, hey, I've done something, and you know, it's going to let you go to sleep at night in a good way.
I think one of the benefits of being a social work student is SSA really kind of teaches you to kind of work with communities from an in-context basis. So I'm always looking about, especially with my clients, how does gender, how does race, how does socioeconomics play a part into the work that I'm doing? Especially with me working with young Black men, I think about them from a systems angle. You know, not only is the function of them being inside of just the immediate classroom, that's a system, inside of the actual school district, how are they looked at? And then you take it to their community. So all these systems are pulling and tugging on each other. So I take that within inside of my work to inform, and it helps me to be a very well-rounded social worker and clinician when I'm working with students. So it just, there are days where I feel like, you know, I have to take the cape off just because I realize these systems were set up before me, and I can do my best at, you know, kind of chipping away at the iceberg, but also just empowering, you know, well, not even empowering. Let me take that word out of it. Helping my clients to see that they have a part that they can play in helping to dismantle systems of oppression such as racism, classism. They have a part in that as well to, you know, really help dismantle the hierarchy. So, just taking a systems approach and just making sure that I'm helping to inform my clients about these ways that the system is using them, how it works. You know, we talk about all of that because through hip hop, it addresses all these types of things, the economic disparities, the kind of gender inequalities. And, you know, it's been a very awesome experience. I feel like that was a terrible answer, by the way.
No, not at all.
I can add a small bit, and this is a story I've told a million times, but it's fantastic to me. So when I was a student at SSA, there was a student, and I think SSA, U of C in particular, right, is a space for abstraction. Like, that's kind of who we are. Like, we find value in thinking at that level, and there is value to that. But I was in a course with Charles Payne, who was the lead, and a student was doing this very U of C thing that I love, and they were like, when we say race, what do we really mean? And they were sort of doing their hands like that, and it was great. And Charles Payne simply said, cross 47th Street. And everybody knew what he meant. Like, he said, when I say race, I mean cross 47th Street and see if you have the same question. And I love that, because he wasn't saying we can't do both at the same time. We could have very abstract, philosophical, sort of ontological questions about race, where it stems from, but we're not going to do that in the absence of thinking about power and identity, right? Like, we know that people who live in different parts of Chicago have a very different experience. And we're not gonna forego that just because we're at the University of Chicago. So I appreciated him saying, we can do both. We can think deeply about the creation of these things, but we can also push each other to have real conversations that bring power dynamics into all that we do.
Great. Okay, we have, I think, 7 minutes left, and there are lots of cool questions that are here. I think I'll ask one more that's particularly for Shaz, and then we'll wrap it up. Perhaps a question for Shaz and Hickel Brown. Can you speak to your view of the civic tech landscape, either in Chicago or otherwise? I'm a master's student in the analytics program, and hoping to use my skill set for public good. And this is
so from Chicago has a group called it's Shy Hack Night. They used to meet in person downtown every Tuesday. Now I think they're online, or they might be doing it via Slack. And it's a wonderful sort of grouping of civic technologists across the city. And this community's now been in existence for years. I think anybody who's interested in civic tech, that's like your good first sort of foray into where you can go and where you can meet other people. Going beyond that, there used to be a Do Good Data conference that Andrew Means used to run, and he was at Harris for a little while and is now doing something else. I think that's still in existence, and it's another space where people come together. More broadly than that, the city of Chicago has a very good civic tech infrastructure as a city versus other cities. I think it's actually a model at this point for other cities in terms of open data and in terms of sort of how they think about a broader developer community. So I think that those are your starting points. I think COVID-19, this coronavirus, is going to radically change the world in terms of civic tech, right? So all of a sudden, the old digital divide arguments are going to come back because now we're going to have to we're going to have to imagine periods of being remote workers and periods of being remote schoolers, and there'll be good old-fashioned conversations about infrastructure and how can we approximate all kinds of direct social contact that we are used to, particularly in the civic engagement space, through these digital means or these sort of spatial distancing approaches. So if you're interested in that, talk to me afterwards, because I think that's a space we're all trying to figure out what's going to happen. And I do think that Shy Hack Night is the sort of entryway. And I should also throw a shout out to the folks at Polsky for this. Their regular Friday night Hack Night in Chicago at the university. It doesn't have a lot of the civic stuff yet, but I think that that's a space where you can find like-minded people and it can connect to the civic stuff in a way as we go forward.
Great, thank you. So we have a few minutes, so I'm not gonna ask any more questions, but I wanted to know if any of you had any parting words. Shaz, you kind of gave yours really well with everything that's going on in the world right now, but Coffee or Dante, if you have any parting words for all of our attendees before we wrap up today.
Any kind of questions, feel free to reach out to me. You can go to my website, www.mademanfoundation.org. I'm also usually around SSA, so if you see me, feel free to pick my brain. If you're looking to become a social entrepreneur or just need a space to kind of, think about how you can make an impact in the grassroots, grassroots way, just feel free to email me through my website, or you can just email me at dante@mademanfoundation.org. And since most of you are students, or you can just email me at dantehenderson@uchicago.edu, either way.
First, thanks Marquita for hosting. This has been a lot of fun. Second, I'd say same thing. My email is kafi@uchicago.edu. If you want to follow up about virtual volunteer opportunities, let's have that conversation. If you want to talk about navigating work and school, we can have that conversation. If you want to talk about navigating bureaucracies, we can have that conversation. If you want to talk about homeschooling while working from home, we can have that conversation. Anything that you've heard that will be useful, I'd love to help. I was able to navigate U of C because of the community that I was able to build, and so I'd love to be a part of that for you, regardless of what division you're in, if that's helpful to you. And I'm by the computer all the time now, so I should be able to get back to you pretty quickly.
All the time. We're by the computer all the time now. Just to underline, yeah, I'm also available, Shaz, Shaz, @uchicago.edu. Send an email. We're happy to help.
Cool. Great. Well, thank you all so much. This was obviously different than we all expected, but I really appreciate all three of you for giving your perspective and for being here and giving a wonderful panel to our attendees. So thank you all so much. And to the attendees, I know that there is a keynote in about 10 minutes, so definitely come see that, okay? So thank you all. Great. Round of applause.
Okay. Thanks, Margarita.
No problem. Bye.